Hello, welcome to the show called The Environment. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm going to be reading an article from the Sierra Magazine, the Summer 2024 edition. The article is entitled, The Future is Old Growth. It was written by Krista Langlois. On his missions to find big trees, Eric Danielson comes across humanity's detritus, often rusty cans and broken glass, the occasional old stone wall or chimney, and once a camp chair lodged in a tree miles from the nearest trail or road. But bushwhacking into the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York on a humid summer morning in 2023, he found no signs that anyone else had been in these woods for a very long time. At first, Danielson's surroundings looked like any other forest in the northeastern United States, a tangle of underbrush and skinny trees fighting for the light, crowded by boulders and stumps. As he walked in deeper, though, the ecology shifted. The pines became larger, the moss thicker, and the forest harder to navigate because of downed trees and 20-foot cliffs. Danielson recalled saying, quote, it was really beautiful, but kind of hard terrain to get around, unquote. He paused in a ravine framed by a waterfall, and then climbing up the next ridge, he saw it, the eastern white pine he would eventually call Bigfoot. At 151 feet tall and more than 16 feet in circumference, it towered over the forest floor. Quote, it's got this enormous footprint, and the trunk just goes up and up, and I think to myself this could be the largest white pine that I have ever seen, unquote, Danielson said. A self-taught botanist who never went to college, and fell in love with trees while living in an off-the-grid cabin, he is now a laboratory technician in the Tree Ring Lab at Harvard Forest. That's the forestry department of Harvard University. And he hunts for big trees in his spare time. Bigfoot, later confirmed to be the largest living member of its species by volume, was one of his largest finds yet. But more remarkable than Bigfoot itself was the fact that it was just one tree in a 550-acre tract of white pine forest that has likely stood since before the Civil War, an entire, intact, old-growth forest hiding in one of the nation's most densely populated and ecologically altered regions. Now, before European colonization, such stands would have been commonplace. As the tallest trees in eastern North America, white pines were said to soar up to 230 feet in pre-colonial times, peppering the vast hardwood forest of the Northeast and Upper Midwest. A white pine sheltered leaders of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy as they drafted the Great Law of Peace, which united five tribal nations and later inspired the U.S. Constitution. Tribal members still know the pine as the tree of peace. But to Europeans, however, white pines represented fuel for conquest. By the 18th century, Europe had few trees left that were tall enough to be fashioned into single-stick ship mast, a construction superior to fastening two shorter logs together. So the colonists coveted the long, straight trunks of eastern white pines. In 1772, King George III decreed that any white pine more than 12 inches in diameter was his personal property to be used for the Royal Navy. Enraged colonists in New Hampshire staged what later became known as the Pine Tree Riot. Regardless of who owned them, White pines were one of the first species that settlers targeted, reducing stand after stand of them to stumps and slash. Once they had mostly exhausted the white pine supply, they moved on to other tree species. Between the 17th and the 20th century, European settlers cleared more than 99% of the forest in New England and New York. Not just once, but two, and even three times. First for agriculture and timber, and then for industry. Northeastern woods have a remarkable ability to grow back. Today, roughly 80% of that region is again shaded by trees. But most modern forests are the kind of scraggly second or third growth that Danielson bushwhacked through to find Bigfoot. Fairly uniform, with trees roughly the same size and age, and unnaturally young. Some estimates place the age of most northeastern forest at around 100 years old. Mere teenagers by arboreal standards. Ecologists generally consider such forest unhealthy, susceptible to disease, and lacking in the complexity that makes old-growth forest so ecologically rich. For generations, most people assumed that old growth simply no longer existed in this part of the world. Bob Leverett, a former engineer who identified new areas of old-growth forest in Massachusetts, said, quote, "In the old days when old growth was brought up, people thought of the Pacific Northwest. A lot of people said, 'Old growth in Massachusetts?'" Well, in the 1980s, Leverett and others began documenting remnants of forest in Massachusetts and beyond that had somehow escaped the colonist axes. The trees weren't as big as you might expect. Cold New England winters and regular wind and ice storms prevent trees from reaching the proportions of the West Coast famous evergreens. But like all old-growth forest, those in the Northeast have evolved through cycles of natural disasters and regrowth, and that differentiates them from forests that have been intensively logged or otherwise managed by people. They have richer soil and a higher diversity of both plants and animals. They store more carbon, and they are more resilient in the face of disease and climate change. They serve as a natural laboratory for studying how forest ecosystems function without human interference. And perhaps just as important, they are places that spark awe and wonder. Over the past few decades, enthusiasts and scientists have identified tens of thousands of acres of old-growth forest in the Northeast. They have found patches in Massachusetts and Maine, New Hampshire and Vermont, New York and Pennsylvania. But until Danielson's mission in the Adirondacks last summer, no one had paid any attention to the area surrounding Bigfoot. Danielson said, quote, "The part I find most mind-blowing is that these old-growth forests have gone undetected. 5 years ago, I wouldn't have thought there was anything like that out there," unquote. As scientists and conservationists and government agencies work to identify, study, and protect the ancient forest of the Northeast, they might also be mapping the region's future. Though old growth makes up only a tiny fraction of northeastern woodlands, even fragmented forests still carry the ecological legacy of the past. That's a quote from the University of Minnesota forest ecologist Lee Freelich. He said this at a conference, and he went on and said, quote, "They still carry the microbes, the genetics, the biodiversity, and that legacy can spread into the adjacent stands," unquote. So enthusiasts are hopeful that by protecting a layer around the remaining patches of northeastern old growth, the old growth can help nurse the surrounding secondary forest back to health. If we allow the northeast old growth to expand outward, perhaps one day it will anchor a corridor of intact, mature woodlands again stretching from Pennsylvania to Maine. It would be an echo of the force that once defined the region, and an atonement, perhaps, for their destruction. One of the most well-studied patches of northeastern old growth is in New Hampshire's Pisgah State Park. One rainy September afternoon, I joined a tour led by Harvard ecologist Audrey Barker Plotkin and Brian Hall. The first hints of fall tinged the treetops orange and red, but the understory was still verdant and the air saturated with humidity, as if the leafy landscape were breathing. A low mist wound through the trees. We hiked up an old logging turned ATV road, past a foggy lake, and turned onto an overgrown trail. If you didn't know where you were going, it would be easy to get lost. The trees were monotonous, their branches close and clawing, and yet we stayed on course. Barker Plotkin and Hall had been here dozens of times, and their predecessors dozens more. Back in 1927, Harvard Forest purchased a grove of about 20 acres of old-growth white pines and hemlocks nestled within the more than 13,000-acre state park. Eventually, we turned off the trail altogether. The topography became more challenging, with waves of boulder-strewn ridges crashing against each other, cedar waxwings, brown creepers, red crossbills, and other songbirds called from the canopy. We waded through a sea of wet hobblebush leaves that left our pant legs soaked, and stepped carefully over cucumber root, a relatively rare understory herb that is indicative of mature forest throughout its range in eastern North America. But still, we were not in the old growth. Not yet. Barker Plotkin, in excitement in her voice, said, "Ooh, we're starting to get into the site." Well, we hiked on. And then, almost imperceptibly, something changed. Perhaps it was only that the hovering rain clouds had sunk closer to the earth, but the forest began to feel darker, more primeval. Noises became muted, as if the soft mosses and decaying logs were absorbing sound the way a fresh snowfall does. The ground became spongier, almost bouncy underfoot. Red efts, the common name for juvenile eastern newts, skittered across the forest floor, and pale stalks of ghost pipe sprouted from the duff. When a local forester named Jeff Jones scooped a handful of decaying wood from inside a snag, that's a standing dead tree, and crumbled it between his fingers, the smell was exquisitely rich and fungal. We were in the old growth. Hall said, "This is magnificent. To us, this tells us what we are missing." And yet the forest looked like nothing I had imagined. For one thing, the trees were much smaller. In 1938, the Great New England Hurricane, one of the region's most destructive storms to date, had knocked down the 300-year-old white pines and hemlocks that had initially led Harvard Forest to purchase this tract. And now those giants are mostly lying on the ground, and the younger hemlock and red maple and black birch and beech have grown up in their place. It's still old growth insofar as it's never been cut, but, as Barker Plotkin put it, it's horizontal old growth. Jones said as he looked around, "The amount of dead wood is awfully extraordinary. You see all these dead trees and think, what other life form has such beauty, even after death?" The upright snags and logs decomposing on the forest floor are as ecologically valuable as standing trees, in part because they provide habitat for microbes, fungi, and invertebrates. Old-growth forests host greater species diversity than younger forests do, including some plants that are not typically found elsewhere, and much of this richness can be traced to the soil. When trees are allowed to die naturally and crumble into dirt, they support unique webs of fungi, which in turn partner with insects, invertebrates, and plants. Certain orchids cannot reproduce without symbiosis with nearby fungi. All of this creates the structurally complex habitat that are favored by pine martens, fishers, woodpeckers, and some species of warblers and thrushes, all of which thrive in old growth. As Frelick, the ecologist, later explained to me, quote, "The whole dynamic of the soil community is different, and the soil is the foundation of the ecosystem," unquote. Soil, composed of hundreds or even thousands of years' worth of dead trees, provides a fertile bed for growing seeds from living trees. Such soil can also contain seeds from more recently deceased trees, which in some cases remain viable for up to 100 years. Some scientists speculate that because such trees lived through past climatic swings, they may have particularly resilient genes, although this hasn't been proved. Saplings that sprout from old-growth seeds might be better equipped to survive modern environmental changes. But taken as a whole, this repository of genes and seeds and symbiotic organisms enables the features of old-growth forest to expand. The seeds grow into new trees at the edges of the old growth, so the species composition of adjacent forest begins to mirror that of the original forest instead of starting from scratch with early succession species. These formerly logged adjacent woods are not old growth, but if they're left alone long enough, they could become virtually indistinguishable from forest that was never cut. In fact, some of the earliest identified virgin forest in the Northeast turned out to have been logged in the 17th century. It had recovered so thoroughly that it fooled even the experts. Forest next to clear cuts or abandoned agricultural land are a totally different story, Frelick said. He went on and said, they are weedy, they have more invasive plant species, and it's taking much longer for succession to occur, on the order of multiple centuries, some scientists predict, and it may never get back at all, unquote. Well, on its own, that is. But there is a chance that people can lend a helping hand. In the past few years, interest in old growth has surged. As more old growth is discovered and scientists learn from it, more people are becoming captivated by it, imagining what their home landscapes might have looked like before the ravages of colonization. Old growth has even caught the attention of the White House. In 2023, the Biden administration announced that it would no longer permit most logging in old growth forest managed by the U.S. Forest Service or other federal agencies. So for all the press that it has received, old growth composes just a fraction of the landscape. Across the United States, roughly 6% of pre-colonial forest remain. In New England, the figure varies, but is generally considered to be less than 1%. As State Extension Forester and University of Massachusetts Amherst Professor Paul Catanzaro put it, quote, there's almost no old growth left. So what do we do with the other 99% of forest, unquote? Well, many scientists and conservationists think the answer is to try to help ecologically young forest approximate old growth, and then use those to connect the scattered stepping stones of genuine old growth. If individual patches of old growth are valuable, a continuous corridor of forest with old growth characteristics would be exponentially more so. It would give flora and fauna the habitat they need to naturally migrate north as the climate warms, and perhaps allow extirpated species to return one day. How to best transform these young forests into mature forest? Well, that's a subject of passionate debate. Catanzaro represents one line of thinking. He believes that although it's critical that some forests be left alone to recover on their own, people can also hasten a forest recovery by actively replicating the conditions that make old growth so biologically rich and resilient. Now, this might include thinning some trees to let others grow bigger, faster, or mimicking natural disturbances by creating gaps in the canopy that allow younger saplings to sprout. Now, both of these happen naturally, but on a longer time scale. It means leaving standing dead trees and logs to create habitat for insects, woodpeckers, and other animals. In specific cases, it could include prescribed burning or controlling invasive species. Regardless of the strategies, the idea is to transform a homogeneous, formerly pastured or logged forest into one that is complex and messy, with a variety of tree ages, a multi-layered canopy, an abundance of deadwood, and some large diameter trees and snags. One analysis indicates that such an approach can restore some old growth-like characteristics in a young forest in as few as 50 years, compared with 100 years or more if a modern-day forest is simply left alone. Catanzaro said, quote, "We're speeding up the clock," unquote. Now, most of the people who turn to Catanzaro to help them accelerate forest recovery are private landowners. Unlike in the West, where state and federal agencies manage large tracts of public land, individuals and families own most of the forest in the Northeast. Although each of these family forests is relatively small, ranging from a handful of acres to hundreds or more, together they make up the bulk of the Northeast forested lands. Catanzaro said, quote, "It's really messy. Every one of those parcels is its own decision-making entity," unquote. Catanzaro has found that a variety of public land managers and family forest owners, including those who use their forest for cutting timber or producing maple syrup, they want to see at least part of their lands return to a more natural, old-growth-like state. And to that end, he helps landowners identify spots on their property that already contain old trees, such as a colonial-era woodlot that was only selectively logged, or a solitary giant standing in a sea of scraggly second growth. Catanzaro assists them to establish permanent conservation easements or other long-term protections around these spots, and then implement a systematic, research-driven framework to speed up the forest recovery. He said, quote, "We can't get back to true old growth, but we can get closer, and I think it's important to try," unquote. Now, even though Catanzaro doesn't advocate for applying such tactics everywhere, his belief that people can accelerate a forest return to old growth-like conditions is controversial. Some scientists and conservationists think the only real way to return to old growth forest is to simply leave the woods alone after establishing permanent protections through conservation easements or legislative actions. David Foster, an ecologist who spearheads an initiative known as Wildlands, Woodlands, Farmlands, and Communities, which aims to protect a network of designated wildlands spanning New England. David said, quote, "The best thing we can do for climate change with much of our forested land is to actually do nothing," unquote. These lands are owned and managed by a variety of entities, from federal and state governments to private landowners to nonprofits. And Foster's group helps ensure that all the forests are protected from current and future management, meaning nothing is cut, or sprayed, or planted, or salvaged. They are simply left to heal. So far, Foster's group has identified or protected about 450 wildlands across New York, and the number grows annually. Other groups are also taking up the cause. A national nonprofit called the Old Growth Network aims to protect one patch of mature forest in each county, while state governments are increasingly committed to setting aside forested lands to buffer the impacts of climate change. Massachusetts' plan to decarbonize by 2050 calls for 40% of the state to be protected, while Vermont is aiming for 50%. Oh, well, darn it, I've got another 3 pages to read, but we're almost out of time. So I guess we're going to have to finish this up the next time we get together. So that was the article entitled "The Future is Old Growth," written by Krista Langlois, and it's from the Sierra Magazine, the summer 2024 edition. And I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the show called The Environment. I hope you have a great week, and I hope you keep on listening. So bye for now.